I'm Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Christian DeQuincy, and we're going to talk about his book, Consciousness from Zombies to Angels, and a little bit more detail into consciousness in general. How are you, Christian? Thanks for being with me tonight.
Oh, hello, Eva. I'm doing really well. Thanks.
So, excuse me, I'm in the South, and we're inundated with pollen, so forgive me if I get choked up sometimes, but I'll try not to.
Okay.
So, before we get started, why don't you tell us just a little bit about who you are, where people can find you, and how you came to do what you're doing today?
Well, let's see, I have a PhD in consciousness studies, in philosophy and religion, and master's in consciousness studies, and I teach philosophy and consciousness studies at John F. Kennedy University in California, and with the University of Philosophical Research in Burbank, Southern California. And I'm also the founder of the Wisdom Academy, which is an online service that offers mentorships in consciousness and conscious transformation, and that's at www.thewisdomacademy.org, and I also have a blog, thewisdomblog.wordpress.com. Let's see, I've been interested in consciousness studies pretty much for as far back as I can remember, I won't get into, I have a story about that to tell, but I won't take up time with that at the moment, but pretty much since I was a kid of 7 or 8 years old, I've been fascinated with the question of what is the relationship between the mind and the body, and how can we explain that? And that's really become the focus of my career, is looking at what is the nature of and the relationship between consciousness and energy, between mind and matter, between mind and body, and how can our understanding of that relationship empower us in our lives? So although I'm trained in philosophy, I'm not just interested in logical and rational explanations of things. I'm interested in our understanding making a difference in our lives. And what that means is that the philosophy that I do and the philosophy that I encourage also includes other ways of knowing, such as feeling and intuition, as well as our senses and our rational faculties.
All right, so your book, by the way, is excellent. You're going to have to promise me that you'll come back, because you know I have a set of questions that I'm interested in. But you got to promise me you'll come back and let's spend the whole hour on just your book. And your other book, I can't remember the name of it, but you talk about it in this one. What's your other book?
Well, the couple of other books. The one you're referring to, I think you mentioned, was Consciousness from Zombies to Angels, which is my current book, and but also my first book, Radical Nature.
Yes. As you say, you talk about free will in there a lot.
The Soul of Matter, yes. And that's just being reissued in a new edition, so that's also a relatively new book as well. On my personal website, deepspirit.com, listeners can go there and find out more information about my other books, Radical Knowing, which is about knowing through relationship, understanding consciousness in and through relationship. And then my fourth one is called Deep Spirit, Cracking the Noetic Code, and that's a novel about the evolution of consciousness from light to enlightenment.
So the first question I have to you is, what is your definition of consciousness? So we'll know what we're talking about.
Yes. Well, yeah, I teach lots of courses on consciousness and have been for many, many years, as well as having written lots of books and articles on consciousness. And the one thing I always avoid doing is defining consciousness. And I have a couple of reasons for that. First is that to define something is, by definition, to delimit it, to put boundaries around it. And I think it's way too premature for us to know in advance what the limits of consciousness might be, or indeed if there are any limits. So that's one meaning of definition. But there's another meaning. A definition usually refers to an objective meaning, the standard meaning. You know, you go to a dictionary to find the objective meaning of a word. And the one thing we know about consciousness is that it is not objective. It is subjective. And so I don't see how anyone can decide that they have the correct definition of the correct meaning of consciousness. And so for those two reasons, I actually avoid giving a definition of consciousness. However, I think it's really important for us to clarify what we mean when we use the word consciousness. And so that's what I do, is I take time in my books and in my lectures and my classes to clarify what I mean by consciousness. And to simplify it, consciousness is the ability to know, to be aware, and to make choices. That's the essence of consciousness, is to be aware, to know, to have an ability to know something, and also to make choices. Anything that can be aware of anything else, including itself, but not necessarily confined to itself, anything that can be aware and that can make choices necessarily has consciousness. So that's the simplest meaning.
It brought up a question here. You said the essence of consciousness. So that means those are attributes of consciousness?
Well, yes, you could say that. You could say they're the attributes. They are also the essence in the sense of the intrinsic nature of consciousness. Is consciousness is what it is to be aware of anything, to know anything, to feel anything, and to be able to make choices. So what consciousness does, it's able to feel and sense possibilities in every moment. And then it can make choices between those possibilities. How we act.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would it be fair to say that consciousness, and this is, again, language is a problem here, the ground of all being?
Well, I don't quite go that far. I would say that consciousness is intrinsic to the ground of all being. In other words, there is no part of being that doesn't have some kind of consciousness going on. But consciousness is not the whole story. Consciousness, as I said, is the ability to be aware, to create intentions, and to make choices. But something else is needed besides the ability to create intentions and make choices. We also need to be able to act, to take action. And that's where energy comes in. So the world, the ground of being, is composed of both consciousness and energy. And in the work that I do, I propose that consciousness and energy, although they're not the same, they always go together. You can never have one without the other. So a world that was consisted only of pure consciousness would be a world where all the greatest intentions in the world could be made, but they could never be manifested. They could never be acted on unless there was also energy to do the action. And so the ground of being is both consciousness and energy. But I'm not saying that energy and consciousness are identical. They're quite distinct, so they always go together.
What do you believe to be the source of the original intention?
Well,
or how do you think that? Well, then I guess that's two questions. The second part would be, how do you think that came to be? Or have you? I'm sure you've thought about that.
Well,
do you have an answer or not? I'm sure you've thought about it.
Well, my answer is, first of all, and let's see if this does answer your question, is that there never was a beginning. So the source is an eternal source. It never had a beginning, and what always existed always had consciousness and always had energy. There never was a time when there was never nothing. So something always existed, and what existed consisted of sentient energy, of energy that tingles with the spark of spirit.
Okay, what is your definition of mind?
Well, mind
big mind and little mind.
Okay, I use the terms mind and consciousness and experience pretty much synonymously. And it's only when we need to get into defining different forms of consciousness do I find it useful to make a distinction between mind and consciousness. So I use the words mind and consciousness pretty much to mean the same reality. And here's how I view it, is that reality consists of two main divisions, or two main buckets of being. And the first is the bucket that we can label non-physical, and that consists of mind, experience, consciousness, soul, spirit. They all fit into that first basket or bucket called the non-physical. And then there's the other basket or bucket, that's the physical, and that consists of tables and chairs and cars and houses and clothes and bodies and everything made of matter. So one bucket could be labeled mind, and the other could be labeled matter. You could similarly call those two buckets consciousness and energy. So one is non-physical, which is mind, soul, spirit, consciousness, and the other is physical, which is matter, energy, and objects.
What about a phrase that we use, or two phrases, big mind and little mind? Do you have a comment about that?
Yeah, yes, I do. I would say that what we call big mind is what I would call in other contexts cosmic consciousness. It is the consciousness of the entire cosmos. Other people might refer to it as God or the divine,
mm-hmm.
or spirit. So that's what I would consider to be big mind. And then little mind is our own egoic minds. You know, that to a large extent, the mind that is talking to you at the moment, and I'm assuming that you're communicating with me from your egoic mind, at least to some extent. And our egoic minds are always informed, at least if we are open, to be informed by the wisdom of the bigger mind. We get ourselves into difficulty and create personal and interpersonal and social problems when we just operate from the illusion that all that really exists is little mind, and we don't open up to the greater wisdom of the mind that exists in the world around us, in nature, in the cosmos.
Where do you believe I understand where big mind resides, but where do you think little mind resides?
Ah, now there's a great question. One of the things that I do usually the first week or two in class when I'm teaching students is to say, okay, now I would like you to point to where you think your mind is, or where your consciousness is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a moment of hesitation, and then some will start pointing to their heart and others to their head, and then others will do what I call the consciousness shuffle, and they will kind of wave their arms all around their body to indicate that it's all over their bodies. And then I point out that actually it was a trick question, that mind or consciousness doesn't exist anywhere. The nature of consciousness is not something that exists in space. Mind does not exist in space. It's not in your head. It's not in your brain. It's not in your heart. It's not in your stomach. It's not anywhere in your body. If you open up somebody's head or their heart or their stomach, you're never going to see their mind or their consciousness in there. But consciousness doesn't have that kind of existence. It doesn't exist in space the way objects exist in space. Consciousness is the subject that knows or feels or is aware of objects, but it is not itself an object that exists in space. So the question, the real question to ask about consciousness is not where is consciousness, but when is consciousness? And we all know the answer to that. It's right now. Consciousness is always now, 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 now. And
Okay, go ahead.
I just want to make that distinction, that it's important to not think of consciousness as though it's an object that can exist in space the way tables and chairs and brains and computers do.
Do you believe consciousness is in gradients?
Oh, yes. There are different forms and different levels of consciousness.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
What
do you interpret me meaning when I say gradients?
I think what I'm understanding you to mean are there different forms and different levels of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Can consciousness evolve from a very low form of awareness?
Mm-hmm.
To a higher form of awareness. I think that's what you mean, and correct me if I'm
That's correct, right
about that.
Yes. Yeah. So, to what do you attribute the various gradients of consciousness in human beings. You know, and I guess what I mean by that, to somebody, and I'm just going to use this phrase lightly, who is awake. And you know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
If we're talking to a fundamentalist and we're trying to explain, the language is so terrible here, the attributes of consciousness, or it's like us talking to a telephone pole, and for them, it's like they're talking to a know-it-all. What do you attribute that to? Field, frequencies, resonance? I don't know.
Okay, those are very good questions. There are actually a few very, very interesting and engaging questions bundled into that question. So going back to why is it difficult to talk to a fundamentalist about consciousness? In my experience, and you know, having conversations with Jehovah's Witnesses and other fundamentalists, it's not so much that they think I'm the know-it-all. I think they're the know-it-all. Is that basically for them, all the answers reside in their scripture, in their Bibles, that everything they need to know, anything anybody needs to know, is already there in the printed word and the word of their gospels and their Bibles. That happens not to be a way that that I value pretty much in terms of getting knowledge about what is real in the world. But to get back to your question, what accounts for that, for a closed mind, whether it's the closed mind of a fundamentalist or the closed mind of a philosopher, which is for me to acknowledge that there are certainly times when my mind is closed and when I'm not aware of the fact that I'm operating from my ego, and then I wake up, and then I realize, oh, I've just been operating from my own ego, and then I do the best I can to open up and let go of that. So what accounts for the lower levels of mind, as to rephrase your question, is the degree to which we are attached to our egos and identify with our egos. And it's not to say that the ego is wrong or a bad thing. It's not. It's actually evolved over millions of years to help us navigate our way through a very complex and at times dangerous world. And so the ego has served us very well, and it does that job very well. But the problem is when the ego takes over, and it sure tries to do that. It takes over and wants us to identify our deepest self with the ego. And that's when things begin to spin out of control and create trouble. It's when we realize that we have an ego, not that we are an ego, that's when things begin to expand and we open up to different levels of consciousness. And letting go of the ego is rarely, if ever, a one-time event. Eckhart Tolle may be an exception to that. He seems to have had an event in his life that was profoundly so transformative that he's liberated himself once and for all from the illusion.
It happened to me, too.
Oh, well, congratulations.
I don't know if it's congratulations or not, because...
Well, I think so. If you've liberated yourself permanently from the illusion that you are your ego, I think that's a wonderful achievement. I think this would be a much brighter, safer, more harmonious world if more people achieved what you've reported you have achieved.
It certainly makes it more amenable to be here.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in everyday physical reality. Okay, back to the interview. What, and you may not know this, it's your philosophy, I don't know. What do you attribute, I mean, what causes one person to be so closed and another person to allow the awareness? I mean, something's happening there.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a frequency or a resonance? You know, the universe, the sound that comes from the universe is B flat. Is it something that has to do with frequency at a certain that we're able to receive, or am I making any sense at all?
No, I do. I understand what you're asking me. I want to step back a little bit here and make a distinction that I've noticed is not familiar to a lot of people, particularly people who are interested in consciousness and the mind, is that earlier on in our conversation, I pointed out that the ground of being is not just consciousness, it is also energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that I made a distinction between energy and consciousness, that energy exists in space and consciousness doesn't exist in space. So Anything that has resonance or vibrations or frequency exists in the domain or the basket or the bucket of what I call the physical. It exists in space. Only things that exist in space can have vibration. That's what vibration means.
Mm-hmm.
It means something moving in space. Consciousness doesn't exist in space, so it doesn't actually have vibrations. It doesn't have a frequency.
I understand. How can some people pick it up and grab it, even if they're not looking for it?
Yeah.
And some people
can. So what I'm saying is that consciousness and energy always go together, and so the energy is vibrating. So the energy of somebody's body is vibrating, and then the consciousness that is associated with that body can feel that vibration.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the consciousness itself that's doing the vibrating. It's the energy that's in the body. So I just wanted to make that distinction. And so it may be the case that when somebody's body, at a quantum level perhaps, is in a much more coherent state,
mm-hmm.
and is vibrating in a particular way, then the consciousness associated with that body, associated with those vibrations, will be itself more coherent and harmonious,
okay.
and therefore more open to communicating and picking up messages from other bodies around it, whether they're bodies of other human beings or bodies of the planet or bodies of other galaxies, who knows what it might be. But that requires a consciousness that's open, that is at a higher level of awareness than, to go back to the example we gave earlier of the closed-minded fundamentalist in whatever hue that shows up. That we need to be open to what I call experience beyond belief. And maybe this is something we can talk about at some point, is that when people often ask me, you know, well, what do you believe about consciousness? I say, you know, I do my best not to believe anything. And by the way, I want to say this to anyone who's listening to our interview right now, is that I don't want anybody to believe anything that I'm saying. I don't put a lot of trust or faith in belief, because a belief is made up of thoughts, and thoughts are frozen fragments of consciousness. At every moment we are having an experience, right now, right now, right now. As soon as we have one moment of experience, it completes itself, it's over, and it becomes something in the past,
mm-hmm.
but it's immediately replaced by a new moment of experience, right now,
yes.
right now, right now. And as we experience that process, we are right in the present moment where consciousness always exists. However, what tends to happen is we then interpret that moment of experience
mm-hmm.
by creating thoughts about the moment of experience. And then we accumulate all of these fragmented thoughts about experiences that once happened to us, whether it was just a moment ago or a month ago or a year ago or a lifetime ago. We accumulate all these frozen fragments of consciousness, our thoughts, and then we hook them together into certain patterns that we think make sense, and we then form a belief about them. But then a belief means it's always rooted in the past. Meanwhile, experience is happening right now in the present moment. But as long as we are attached to and focused on and mesmerized about our beliefs, we are not paying attention to what's actually happening right now in our experience. And that's where wisdom lies. And so I much prefer to encourage people to be far less attached to what you believe. In fact, with many of my students, I have a practice where I encourage them to let go of their cherished beliefs, those beliefs that they just absolutely know to be true. Let go of those, loosen up attachment to those, and see what happens. And I guarantee them that if you let go of your beliefs, you won't die, you won't evaporate. What's much more likely to happen is you will experience a sense of liberation by paying attention to what you are actually experiencing, because it's experience that connects us to reality. Consciousness, as we said a moment ago, is happening right now, right now, right now. Well, that's exactly when reality happens, right now,
mm-hmm,
right
mm-hmm.
now, right now. So the way to know reality is through experience, through consciousness, not through our beliefs.
Okay, I'm going to ask you kind of like a long question here. It's actually a couple of questions in one question.
Yeah.
Does the presence of sensate and cognitive awareness, or both, assure that consciousness is active? And do you believe these to be attributes of consciousness or signifiers of consciousness?
Sensate and cognitive awareness?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do. That any awareness already and automatically implies consciousness, as I'm using the term.
Okay.
So it would be impossible to have any kind of awareness, whether it's sensate awareness or cognitive awareness, unless there was already some consciousness doing the awaring, if you like. However, sensate and cognitive consciousness is not the whole story. There are other forms of consciousness other ways of knowing that we need to acknowledge and cultivate and integrate and develop, such as feeling and intuition, that cannot be reduced to cognition or to information gathered through the senses.
Do you believe that consciousness can be active without the presence of either one of these attributes? In other words, or if so, would it be correct to say that consciousness merely exists in potentia? Does that make sense?
Well, that's probably one of the deepest questions we could get into. Does consciousness just exist in potentia? I don't think it just exists in potentia. Because right now you and I are actually having a conversation, and I am actually aware of listening to your questions. So that's not just in potentia, that's actual. Consciousness isn't just possibility, it is also actual. Consciousness is what brings possibility or potentiality into manifestation. It's what we've recognized and learned from quantum physics. When a quantum physicist is observing a quantum system, until that observation is made, that quantum system remains in potentia, and it's only when it's observed, and of course it doesn't have to be a human scientist to do the observation, it could be any sentient being, but it requires some sentient being to observe the quantum system, and as soon as that happens, then in technical language, in quantum physics, it's called the collapse of the quantum wave function. In other words, the possibilities now collapse down into one actuality, and a quantum event has happened. And those are the building blocks of the manifest real world that we live in. So consciousness is, if you like, it's the connective tissue between the domain of possibility, between the domain of potentia, between what might be and what actually happens. Consciousness is the potency that brings possibility into manifestation.
Okay, you just brought up something in my next question, so I'm just going to read you the question and see if you have anything else to say about it, okay?
Sure.
Is it really enough to say that consciousness collapses the state vector in quantum mechanical processes? Or should we say consciousness mediates the formation of the measured state vector?
Well, be interested to know for you what is the difference between collapsing it and mediating it. If it's mediating it, what's happening in the mediation?
I'm just asking questions.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Well, if I start inserting what I think here, then it will get off on tangents. So I just, you know, however you interpret that to be, because I ask everybody these kind of same questions.
Okay. So repeat the question.
Is it really enough to say that consciousness collapses the state vector in quantum mechanical process? Or should we say consciousness mediates the formation of the measured state vector?
Well, if it mediates it, I would need to know what's it mediating it between. And as far as I understand what's going on is that consciousness directly collapses the quantum wave function.
Okay.
In the absence of consciousness, what we know from quantum theory is that there is no collapse, that the state vector remains in potentia, in possibility. And it's only when consciousness, when an observer actually notices what's going on in the quantum domain, does the state vector collapse, do the possibilities collapse and become an actual event. And those become the building blocks of our world, of reality. So there may be some way in which it's meaningful to say that consciousness mediates the collapse of the wave function.
I guess my real question is, and you're answering. I just want to finish it out since you've talked about it some. The real question is in what way do these different processes depend on consciousness?
Well, that is probably the greatest mystery confronting modern science. It's a total mystery to modern science how it is that consciousness collapses the wave function. Modern science is based on the metaphysics of materialism, which is the understanding that the fundamental nature of reality is pure matter or pure energy without any trace of consciousness whatsoever. And the assumption is that the world began about 13.7 billion years ago in a Big Bang, and it was just very, very hot plasma energy that then over the eons evolved and became more and more complex, forming different kinds of matter, atoms and molecules, and eventually cells and nervous systems that produce brains, and that's only at that point in time did consciousness come into being. That's the standard story of scientific materialism. It happens to make no sense whatsoever, because it assumes that you can get something non-physical, consciousness, out of a bunch of ingredients that are entirely physical, entirely non-conscious to begin with. That would require a miracle, but miracles are precisely what modern science denies are impossible. So scientific materialism is in the very embarrassing situation of requiring a miracle to be true, and yet it denies the possibility of miracles. So scientific materialism is in this situation where in order to be true, it must be false. And that's really a difficult challenge for any particular philosophy to find itself in.
How would you define the irreducible unit?
Define which?
The irreducible unit. And that's probably one of my words.
The irreducible unit.
Yeah, what would that be to you?
Well, to me, I can talk about it in two ways. One would be the quantum of action, which is the irreducible element of the physical world that we know of through physics, that there is, that a quantum, by definition, is indivisible, that a quantum always comes in wholes. That's what the word means. It's a whole package of action, a package of energy. So that would be the indivisible unit from the perspective of quantum physics. From the perspective of philosophy, I would go along with my favorite philosopher, who is the British metaphysician called Alfred North Whitehead, who said that the ultimate indivisible units are actual occasions. And what he means by that is that every moment is a moment of experience. And it's these moments of experience that are the fundamental building blocks of reality. And it's Whitehead who pointed out that every moment we have an experience, but the moment only lasts for an infinitesimal amount of time, and then it completes itself and becomes an expired experience. It becomes an object in the past for the next moment of experience in the present to have an experience of the past. And it's that process between the collapsing of the moment of now into the past, into just a moment ago, from a subject becoming an object, that process is the fundamental nature of reality. So the unit, the fundamental unit, is not a unit in the sense of a thing. It's the unit in the sense of a period of time, which would be you could think of it as a quantum bubble, quantum bubble of time, and that would be the fundamental nature of what is real, of what is actual. And that includes both mind and matter, both consciousness and energy, always bundles together into this unit called an actual occasion.
Now, this next question, we've kind of talked about it, but I need to ask it just kind of point blank. Do you think that consciousness is a field or a wave or both?
No, I don't. Going back to what I said earlier is that only things that exist in space can have the quality or the characteristic of a field. A field is something that's extended in space, whether it's the field where cows munch away chomping on the grass, or whether it's an electromagnetic field. All fields exist in space. And so consciousness doesn't exist in space, so it doesn't have a field aspect to it. It doesn't have waves. A wave is something that vibrates in space. Consciousness doesn't vibrate in space because it doesn't exist in space. So, no, consciousness is not a mechanism. vibrations are one of the ways that mechanisms work. Consciousness doesn't work through mechanism. It works through meaning, through shared meaning. Mechanisms work by exchanging energy from one point in space to another point in space. Just think of, you know, the cog wheels in an old-fashioned clock, not a digital clock, but an old-fashioned mm-hmm. clock run by cogs, of the gears in your car. So energy is transmitted from one point in space to another. That's what a mechanism is. Consciousness doesn't work that way. There's no mechanism of consciousness. Consciousness works by sharing meaning. So, for example, you and I are having this conversation right now, and to some good degree, to some extent, we are understanding each other because we are understanding the meaning that's been communicated. But that meaning is not traveling through the atmosphere. It's not traveling down through the phone lines. You can open up a phone line and you will never see any meaning in there. All you will see are a bunch of flowing electrons. So meaning is not something that travels through space. You and I are picking up, and I'm using that term metaphorically, we are sharing the meaning of the words that we are using. The sound of the words is traveling through space, but the meaning itself is something that we share in consciousness, and that sharing does not occur in space. It transcends spatial dimension.
Okay. Do you believe that we have complete free will?
No, not complete. We are determined to a great extent. The fact that we are embodied beings means that there is a lot of mechanism, a lot of determination going on in our bodies. Even in our minds to a great extent run on habit. Beliefs are habits of mind. And for most of the time, most of us operate according to our belief system. And as long as we are operating from our belief systems, we are not exercising free will or choice. We are operating from habits, old habits of mind, old ways of thinking. And so we are determined both by the physicalness of our bodies and the physicalness of the environment around us. We're determined by our genes, by our nervous system, by our brains. But that's not the whole story. In addition to the determinism that pushes us along, if you like, it's the pressure of the past pushing us into the present moment. But in addition to that, we also have the spark of spirit in every moment, the spark to make a choice. And so we can make choices from the possibilities that exist in every moment. Every moment is like the growing tip of the past, but it also comes shrouded in a cloud of possibilities. And then consciousness is what chooses among those possibilities to introduce the possibility of something new happening in the next moment that could not be predicted according to the determinism of everything that happened up until that point. So we do have free will, and we are also determined. I think the spiritual path is one of minimizing the degree to which we are determined, both by our belief systems and by our embodiment, and cultivate the ability to make more choices, to realize more possibilities. That's one way of understanding the spiritual path. It's to shift the ratio between the degree to which we are determined and the degree to which we are free. But I think we will always have some degree of determinism happening, and just like we will always have some choice, even if we are imprisoned in solitary confinement, we still have the choice to either accept where we are and what's happening, or the choice to resist it and reject it.
Okay.
So we always have some choice.
For.
Yep.
I was looking for, we have the choice to change our react, to whether we react or not, right?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. It's not always an easy process, but yes, we always have that choice.
But I'm going to, and I'm doing this for my listeners because I kind of do this for a lot of the luminaries that I'm questioning about this. I'm going to do it with you, too. Even though you pretty much covered it, I just want to say it this way. Imagine that you are a 2-year-old strapped in a car seat in the back seat, and your car seat has a little yellow steering wheel. And consciousness, or God, or source, whatever you want to call it, is in the front seat driving the car. You come up to a stop sign, the playground's on the right and the grocery store's on the left. Conscious God says, I'm going to the grocery store, and you go, oh no, we're going to the playground. whose steering wheel is going to work and why? Do we have a choice there?
If we are the infant in the backseat, we do have the choice.
Is there a potential for will there in that little yellow steering wheel to work?
So we can turn the yellow steering wheel. It's not going to make the tiniest bit of difference on the direction the car is moving. So we can certainly exercise the will to turn the little yellow steering wheel, but it's not going to have any effect on the direction of the car. So we can make choices, and our choices can also be embedded in an illusion that they're going to make a difference when they don't. So we can make choices to take action, and we do this all the time in different parts of our lives. We make choices to take certain actions, and we certainly have the choice and the power to take those actions. But where we often fall short is thinking that those actions are going to lead to a particular result. And to go back to your very interesting metaphor, they're only going to lead to that result if our turning of the little yellow steering wheel happens to coincide with the real steering wheel that the divine or the greater consciousness is turning. It's only when our intentions are aligned with the divine intention, with the intention of the cosmos of the universe itself, that our intentions actually have potency.
So our really only free will there is the free will of how we're going to react, that it's not going to the playground, right?
Unless our free will happens to be an expression of the greater will of the cosmos.
Right, okay.
Expressing itself through us. So there are definitely times when our will is making a difference in the world. Those are the times when we are open to the divine or the greater will of the cosmos expressing itself through our little egoic will. That can happen, and it does happen. Most of the time, however, the egoic will is operating under the illusion that it actually can turn that little yellow steering wheel and make a difference.
So I have two questions here. One of them will be, we know that in physical reality, like Bill Tiller's experiments or Robert Johns at Princeton, we know that intention, cohesive intention, can manipulate reality. If you're in that altered state where your field is very cohesive. Let me see if I can pull my question back together. So how much do you think that we're in a movie and everything's pretty much predetermined unless we're able to get in that very cohesive force, that very cohesive place, and then we can subtly manipulate it? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I know what you're asking. It's actually, in many ways, a variation of just the
yes.
question you asked me a moment ago. It's just a little bit more sophisticated version of it. So the big question here, of course, the $64 trillion question that you're actually asking at the moment is, who is it that makes the choice?
Yeah.
When we say, I choose, who is the I? Who is this I that's choosing? I don't think, given an hour on the radio, given a month on the radio, that we would have enough time to adequately and sufficiently answer that question. That's the perennial question that lies at the heart of spiritual tradition since time immemorial. Who is it? Who is this I? Who is the thinker of the thoughts? Who is it that makes choices? And, you know, we can talk about that for a long time, but I don't think our talking will ever come to any final conclusion in answering that question. That question is very much like a Zen koan. It's something that we need to live into rather than give an answer to. So the question, who am I, or who is it that chooses, is something that needs to direct awareness back into itself, and rather than feel compelled to come up with an answer that can be expressed in language, engaging with that question in a profound way can lead to a kind of transformation that in itself becomes the answer. Who we are becomes the answer rather than what we say.
a very good answer. I like it. Okay. Do you think that the conception of self could perhaps be a vast collection of duals?
Of duals? Of dualities?
Yeah.
Did you say, is the conception of self? Is that what you asked?
Yes.
Well, yeah, every concept is necessarily dualistic. So the concept of self is dualistic because it involves the opposite, which is the idea of no self. So every concept is necessarily dualistic, which is not to mean it's bad. I mean, dualistic distinctions is how we actually can understand things in language and in thought. So I'm not coming down on dualism. What I am interested in as a practice is for us to find ways to transcend the dualisms of concepts and to engage much more in the practice of what I call sacred silence, where we get beyond language. I've done a lot of talking in this interview so far. I'm very aware that I'm speaking very rapidly, trying to get as much information across as possible. However, I think a much more effective way for us to communicate, particularly if we were face-to-face, would be just to sit together in silence and just be together and not have to speak, not to have to ask and answer questions. So there's a power in silence that is unfortunately very alien to our culture, to our society. It's something that I would like to see emphasized much more in our educational system, is the value and the power of just being, sitting in silence. It doesn't have to be sitting. It could be walking or running or doing something. But just to be in silence.
This world doesn't know how to do that as a mess.
Yeah.
Anyway, we've only got like 12 more minutes. I have one more question, then I'm going to let you talk about whatever you want to talk about. Because I've asked you all my stuff. I'm sorry. I want to talk about how consciousness communicates with, I mean, brain's got to do something. We know it doesn't think. I visualize it as some sort of processor, but it's got to receive that information somehow. Do you think it does that, and I don't know the word for this, so I'm going to use like Morse code, like by frequencies and resonance, let's say some kind of intent, an intention is asserted from consciousness, and brain receives those signals and interprets what they are for you, I would assume, based on your conditioning. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I mean, the brain, without a doubt, does play a very, very significant role in shaping what goes on in our awareness, what goes on in consciousness. And so the degree to which modern neuroscience is investigating the brain to see how, you know, through fMRI scans and PET scans and so on, to see what goes on in the brain when people are in a particular state of consciousness, that can be very useful information. Where it becomes misleading, and it happens quite a lot, is when people think that what they see happening in the brain is what's happening in consciousness. That's a very, very mistaken conclusion to arrive at. There's no way that what goes on in the brain equals what goes on in consciousness. Nevertheless, it's true that whatever happens in the brain has an effect on what goes on in consciousness. And the reverse, of course, is true, that whatever choices we make will show up as certain things happening in the brain. And that's one of the things we can see from these fMRI scans. And so one of the more exciting developments in neuroscience during the past couple of decades is the discovery that the brain is actually very malleable. It's very plastic. They refer to it as neuroplasticity. Well, up until maybe about 20 years ago, the standard dogma in brain science was that pretty much beyond the age of adolescence, the brain was set in stone for the rest of our lives, and that was it. And that was a pretty bleak conclusion to come to. It basically meant that there's no point in trying to change anything about your personality or yourself after the age of, who knows, 20, maybe 18, 25, but at some point that you're set in stone and that's it. What they've now realized by watching what goes on in the brain when people do create intentions and people do exercise choice is that actually it creates new neural pathways, new parts of the nervous system start to grow. And so we can actually change what's called the wiring in the brain to set up new behavior patterns. And so it does make a difference what we think and what we choose mm-hmm. in terms of what happens in the brain. So that's why spiritual practice and psycho-spiritual practices such as affirmations can be effective, is they lay down new neural pathways, new ways the brain operates. It's like creating new channels for the brain to flow through, and then that can have an effect back on our behavior.
Does the mind think or does it simply know?
Well, the mind does both. It thinks, but thinking is one way that the mind knows things, and the mind also. Excuse me?
How does it think? Now, when we say this, are we talking about big mind or little mind?
Well, in this case, I'm talking about the little mind, the egoic mind.
Let's talk about big mind.
Does the big mind think?
Or does it simply
I would say
know?
The big mind thinks through little mind. That's how the big mind thinks.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Now let's talk about your zombie book. I have a man, Gerald Schroeder. I don't know if you've read his book. His first one, I think, is called From Science to God. He's an MIT physicist, but he's also a theologian, so it's an interesting combination. He talks about in his book how when the first humanoids, or whatever you want to call them, the first upright beings with a brain that could think, came along, that it was soulless. And in his book with physics, he like the one page will be the physics, and the page beside it will be the Talmud, where he's, you know, going down the two rows of pieces of information and comparing the two, how they support one another. So it kind of made me think about what you're talking about, zombies. So do you think that, I mean, I think that it must have existed at some point, if his work is correct. You know, who knows? I don't know. But do you think those type beings still exist?
No, I don't. In my book, Consciousness from Zombies to Angels, I talk about what are called philosophical zombies. And these are just imaginary creatures that don't actually exist. And the idea is that a philosophical zombie is a creature that is like a human being in every physical respect. They have blood and bones and nervous systems and brains exactly like ours. They bleed if cut.
That's exactly what he said, and he said it was in the Talmud.
Yeah, and so that's a thought experiment. Such beings don't actually exist.
Never have.
According to my understanding of the nature of reality, is remember earlier on in our conversation, I said that the ground of being is consciousness and energy. Mm-hmm. So that means that there never was a time when there wasn't consciousness, and there never was a time when there wasn't some kind of embodiment. So whether we go back a million years or 2 or 3 million years or a billion years or back to the Big Bang, there was still some consciousness present, still some ability to feel and to make choices all the way back and all the way down. That's the only way we can make sense of the fact that today we are made up of matter, that's made up of cells, that's made up of molecules, that's made up of atoms, that's made up of subatomic particles, that's made up of quanta or quarks or superstrings or whatever it is. Whatever it is, all the way down, there has to be some degree of consciousness at every level. Otherwise, it becomes a complete mystery to explain how come we are made of that stuff, and yet we are bodies that can think and can feel and can make choices. The only way to account for the fact that we, as embodied beings, can think and feel and make choices is to assume that at every level of everything that constitutes us, at our cells, at our molecules, at our atoms, at our subatomic particles, that there must be some degree of choice and consciousness there too. So there never was a time when there was some beings made up of matter that didn't have some degree of consciousness. That idea, as far as I can tell, is incoherent. It makes no sense whatsoever to think that there could be beings that didn't have some degree of ensoulment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, we got about 3 minutes. Do you want to just talk about what you want, or do you want me to ask you the other million questions I have?
Well,
that means you have to come back, so I want to give you some time to talk about what you
want. Well, we can go back. I just want to just refer to a comment that you made, oh, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 minutes into a conversation that really caught my attention, and I resisted asking you a question because you're the one who's interviewing me, but I was very interested to know what happened to you when you said you had a moment or an event in your life similar to Eckhart Tolle where you transcended the illusion of being identified with your ego. That to me is a fascinating event, and I would love to hear more about that. Maybe we don't have time to do that right now. But
well, what if I call you back after the show?
Sure, yeah.
I'll do that.
Actually, if you do call me back after the show, let's see. Yes, you can. Yeah,
okay.
You can. I've got another call coming up at 7 o'clock my time, which would be 10 o'clock.
Okay. Because it's kind of a story, and I don't have time to tell you in just this short time.
Yes.
So let me ask you this. You talk in your book about electrons being conscious.
Yeah.
Did you just choose electrons over protons and neutrons? And also, if an electron's conscious, then we know that electrons are pretty much the fundamentals of mass. That means even a rock is conscious to some degree, right?
Well, yes and no. Here's where it's important to make a distinction. The philosophers, that's their currency. Philosophers are in the business of making these very fine distinctions. So what I would say is that all the molecules that make up a rock have their own degree of molecular consciousness, and all the atoms in those molecules have some degree of atomic consciousness. But the rock as a rock does not have rock consciousness in the way a human being has human consciousness, or a bat or a bird has bird or bat consciousness. A rock is just a collection of individual molecules that don't have any unitary coherence, the way the cells in a living organism does. So a living organism is made up of parts that form themselves into a unit, and therefore experience unified consciousness. A rock is just a heap. It's just a bunch of molecules squashed together, but the rock doesn't have any unit coherence. And so I would say, no, a rock as a rock doesn't experience rock consciousness.
Doesn't have awareness, I guess.
Hmm?
That's all right. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I have one more question I want to ask you before we hang up.
There is consciousness in the molecules that make up the rock. And so when people claim to have a communication with the rock, I don't have difficulty at all accepting that as a plausible description of their experience. I would say that what they're doing is they are actually having a communication with the sentience in the molecules of that rock.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you hear a high-pitched noise in your head?
You mean right now as we speak?
Anytime.
In general.
This high-pitched frequency? You might think it's tinnitus.
Yeah, I'm not somebody who has that, but I know.
Do you ever have it?
You know, I think I probably have, like after it's been a long time now, but maybe after a very loud rock concert that I attended, I might
have
a ringing
kind of noise.
Ringing in my ears sometime.
Have you ever been out in the woods where it's so silent that it's screaming?
Ah, yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Okay.
Actually, I have that just yesterday.
One thing that I've learned, and we got time, we're going to get cut off soon. We got like a minute and a half. On every single luminary that I've interviewed that's actually had a spiritual epiphany experience, they all have that sound. Irvin Laszlo said to me, Eva, it's B flat. You know, Irving, do you know Irvin?
Yes, I do.
You know, he's a child prodigy in music, and so he knows his sounds, and he said, Eva, it's B flat, which interestingly is the frequency of silence and hertz. And also the sounds that come from the black hole. So I just think that's very interesting that we all have that sound when we become conscious. But it also, there's a physiological thing, too, that goes on, I think. is that, you know, I think our, and I don't, the word language here is the problem, our resonance is much faster than everybody else's, and it burns up magnesium because, you know, magnesium is highly flammable, and magnesium deficiencies causes tinnitus, so I think that it's a good thing and a bad thing at the same time. And I've noticed when I have that sound and meditate on that sound, things happen a lot quicker, so it makes me wonder if it's the frequency of that the original intention was placed upon for things to start happening. And now we got to go. Thank you for coming on my show. Think about that, and when you come back next time, I'll let you tell me what you think.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the time and your questions, and I look forward to having another conversation with you.
Oh, I do too. It's been great. Thank you. I appreciate it. And good night.
Good night to you. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health. Integral Health.
You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Hare.